Okay, so we have been looking at these things of giving rise to kind of a sense of confidence and faith in the Buddha. The idea that we have been looking at is the five spiritual faculties, and then how that faith then transforms into all these other qualities that are necessary for developing the entire path, the meditation practice and everything else. This is what this is about. So what we're seeing now, we're seeing kind of the development of the good qualities in action, how this works and how they're given rise to her. So by reflecting in the Buddha in the right way, it is possible then to give rise to these good qualities, but it is not always easy. You know, it has to be kind of, you need to keep that in mind, and sometimes you need to develop these things for a while for them to really be able to have an effect. So how does this work then? So we have been looking at the various qualities of the Buddha, and then this is what happens next as a consequence of that. When the noble disciple recollects the Tathagata, the Buddha, on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by desire, ill will, or confusion. On that occasion, his mind is simply straight, based on the Tathagata. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. This is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population, as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Buddha. So this is the ideal sequence of what happens when you do these recollections in the right way. So they can be very powerful, they can take you all the way up to samadhi, and then of course even beyond samadhi, because that's kind of the samadhi has a higher purpose. And this is kind of what you're trying to aim at here, what kind of the purpose of this is. So the idea of faith or a confidence is actually can be very powerful. So when you recall the Tathagata in the right way, your mind is no longer obsessed by these defilements. And the reason for that is because you are thinking about the Dhamma, you are pointing your mind in a different direction, you understand where happiness, real satisfaction and contentment is to be found. You don't look for it in the wrong place anymore, because you are in tune with the Dhamma, with the teachings of the Buddha, with his qualities. So for that reason, these defilements don't arise at that particular point. But you can see it relies on the fact that you think about the Buddha in the right way. Yeah, otherwise it doesn't work. So it has to be that real appreciation of what the Buddha really is about. Then these things start to work. And as I said, it is not always easy to do this, or it takes some training, is probably a better way of putting it. So don't despair if you feel that it is hard or you can't do it. It is fair to say it's only a minority of people who are able to use this kind of reflection in a way that really works. Because you give those things up, your mind is straight. Straight here is the idea of it not seeing things clearly. It's similar to seeing things clearly, similar to right view. And the opposite of straight is crooked. And crooked mind is the one that is full of defilements. You don't see things straight anymore. Your mind is bent. You have vested interests and all these kind of things, and you don't really see what is going on. It's the idea of straightness, and the straightness is based on the Tathagata, the Buddha, as the object. And then you have this beautiful sequence coming up. Then when the noble disciple, when the mind is straight, you gain inspiration in the meaning. The meaning here is the atta. It doesn't just mean meaning in the sense that you understand the goal of these teachings. You understand the purpose, where they lead, what this is all about. Here you get the feeling, because this is exactly what knowing what the Buddha is about means, that you also know where where these teachings are heading, what they are about, because that is exactly what the preaching of the Buddha is about. You see the qualities in the Buddha, the path that he teaches, and you understand what these teachings, where they lead you. And you understand that you have finally found something that can actually give you real meaning in life, real purpose. Not empty goals, but real goals to be aimed for. Everything else is kind of empty by comparison. So you see that is what the idea of meaning is here. You get inspiration in that. The Pali word for inspiration is Veda. And the word Veda has a double meaning. It means both, it is derived from the word vid on the one hand, vid meaning same word as vijati, the three insights we talked about before. So it means like understanding, it means seeing something, having confidence because you understand. That is why again the word confidence is often better than faith, because it implies a degree of understanding. But Veda also has to do with feeling. It is also related to the word Vedana, which is the second of the five personality factors, the khandhas, the aggregates. And as such, it is also that inspiration. So this is why saddha, faith or confidence in Buddhism, has these two aspects to it. The confidence, the feeling aspect, but also the knowledge aspect. It's like unifying the cognitive and the affective being the feeling, the cognitive being the understanding aspect of things. This is very kind of good, if you just go by feelings, it is dangerous. If you just go by intellect, then it is dry and it doesn't work. It's when the two come together that things really are powerful and really work right. You get inspiration in the meaning, inspiration in the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the teaching of the Buddha. When you see that these teachings are heading you towards a real meaning, a real purpose, a real goal, this is what the Dhamma is about. You're inspired by these teachings. And you gain joy connected with the Dhamma. The joy here being the pamuja, one of the preliminary joys on the path as this path starts to work in your meditation practice. So you can use this kind of contemplation very gently while you are meditating on the breath, for example. If you already have, in the past, had access to a little bit of joy connected with thinking of the Buddha, you can kind of bring that to mind, nudge the mind, bring up that perception very gently, and then you bring up the joy, and then you can take that joy forward together with the breath. And then you can come back to the breath again. You let go of that perception of the Buddha, or you leave it at the back of the mind as a kind of something that is there supporting the practice, and then you carry it forward by watching the breath. And then what happens then is this sequence that we find many, many places in the suttas, a very common sequence, and for that reason obviously very important. From that joy, you gain the rapture. The rapture is the piti. They are just different kinds of joy. One a bit more profound, deep than the other one. I don't know the word rapture. I think the word joy is to me more kind of makes more sense to me anyway. And then as you keep on practicing the meditation, gradually this transforms and becomes more peaceful. You get the tranquility, the solidity of body and mind, and you don't want to move at all anymore. You're really happy where you're sitting, and then that tranquility brings with it this profound pleasure, the sukha, the deep kind of happiness inside, the deep contentment, and you just feel you start to reach these very profound states of the path. This is where samadhi becomes possible, because that pleasure is what draws the mind into samadhi, because it's such a beautiful state. You don't want to do anything else in the whole world. Samadhi and stillness happens as a consequence. And that, of course, is then the foundation for the true insights on the path. So this is the noble disciple who dwells in balanced amid an unbalanced population. Unbalanced population because we are unbalanced by the defilements of the mind. It unbalances us. We are drawn this way, drawn that way. When you have samadhi and you have mindfulness, the mind is kind of, you have this sense of being in control of yourself. You are balanced. The mind is not kind of pulled this way and that way. You have a kind of evenness of mind. Whereas the majority of people in the world, they don't have that. So you start to feel in control of your life. You start to feel that the mind is not kind of jumping around, being sad one second, happy another one, and then kind of feeling pleasures one minute, feeling displeasure the other one. But actually you have this evenness throughout the day. Yeah? And this is the incredible benefit of practicing this path as you move in that direction. Yeah? Unafflicted, amid an afflicted population, suffering is decreasing because all this jumping around is decreasing. Yeah? You are feeling generally more at ease, more relaxed, everything heading in the right way. Yeah? And as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, this here again refers to the stream entry, you develop recollection of the Buddha. So this is the purpose of this. Why we do the recollection of the Buddha, why we do recollection of the Dhamma, is the same for the Dhamma, same for the Sangha, same for sila, conduct, same for chaga, generosity, and also the same for deva anusati, recollection of the devas also. Is this joy that it's possible to get reborn in such a wonderful way just by practicing these things. There are other ways too to give rise to this kind of joy, and we'll look at one of those afterwards, just further down here, but these are kind of the main things talked about in the suttas. So I thought now I would have a quick look also at the recollection of the Sangha, how that might work. So this is the next one here. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Sangha. This is the noble Sangha. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way. That is, the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciple is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. So this is the Sangha, so this refers to a noble Sangha, the people who are Aryans, who have direct insight into the teaching of the Buddha. And see here, they're practicing the good way, suppatipanno. It just means, what does it mean, suppatipanno? It just means it's a good path, a path that leads to a good place, has a good destination. Why are they practicing that good way? Because they have internalized the path. Path is now part of them. They don't have any choice anymore. They have to practice that path because they know what it is and they know where it leads. And so it is kind of part of your psychological makeup, and you can't avoid practicing this path. So you are practicing it. Suppatipanno. It leads in a good direction, and it is a good path. It is the straight way. Yeah, it is not the roundabout way. It is the shortcut. Yeah, this is the shortcut, straight way. It is not the kind of the long cut or anything like that. This is the shortcut. So if you want a shortcut, this is the one. Don't try to find a shorter variety of the shortcut, because if you try to find a short shortcut, you're going to find the long one instead. So be very careful with these shortcuts. Always be very skeptical. Yeah, this idea that in later Buddhism they found some kind of path that was shorter than the one that the Buddha taught. Does that really make any sense? To me, it makes absolutely no sense at all. I don't know, I find it kind of strange that people sometimes believe these things. I mean, this is the whole point of having a Buddha, is that he has realized these things and he knows what's going on. And then someone comes a few centuries or millennia and says, yeah, actually, the Buddha taught that, but this is a really fast one. Yeah? This is the one you should take. Be very, very skeptical. That's what I recommend. This is the shortest path. Practicing the true way, nyaya patipanna. The nyaya in Buddhism is the dependent origination. So they are practicing the path of dependent cessation. The nyaya, dependent origination, dependent cessation. Their life, the things are gradually ceasing for the Aryas. So why is that? Well, because the dependent origination or dependent cessation, it starts off with ignorance, with avijja, and that avijja is gradually being abandoned by the noble ones. They have already taken a big chunk out of avijja by acquiring right view. A big chunk has already been taken out, and then gradually they are decreasing it over time until eventually they become arahants. So this is what is going on. And as you do that, it affects the whole sequence of dependent origination or dependent cessation. When ignorance ceases, then the sankharas, the second factor, the activities that you do change according to that ignorance. That changes your whole practice, the craving, the whole practice changes. Your suffering goes down, you can only get reborn in certain places, and eventually the whole thing is eliminated. So you're practicing the path of cessation, nyaya patipanno. Samichi patipanno, samichi just means proper. So you are doing what is appropriate, you know the right conduct, you know what should be done. You have no doubt about these things anymore. You are immersed in the Noble Eightfold Path, almost as if you become the Noble Eightfold Path at this point. That's really what you are as an Aryan. You're a little bit more than that, but that becomes a very important part of it. Four pairs of persons, eight types of individuals. Yeah, the stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and arahant. And what distinguishes them is just the amount of defilements they have abandoned, the number of fetters they have given up. So as you move up this hierarchy, you are less and less tied to samsara. You're giving up the things that tie you down, feeling more and more liberated and free as you move up. The other four of these eight types, they are just the ones who are practicing. They're on the path for the realization of the other four. It means that they will realize this in this life, later on in this life, at the latest. Don't need to worry too much about that. These are all just a kind of classification of the areas. And then it says that this Sangha of the Blessed One's disciple, they're worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings and reverential salutation. The reason, of course, why they are worthy of that is because they have the key, they have access to the most highest thing that anyone can want. So they are the teachers of the world. Yeah, and if you are a teacher and you are able to give your disciples and the students access to the most profound truth of the universe, we always respect our teachers to some extent. Yeah, teachers are someone who gives access to some understanding and knowledge, so we have some respect for teachers, and that is how school operates and how universities operate. But these are the highest teachers, because they give you access to the highest knowledge, and that's why they are worthy of these giving in return. You give them something in return, which is supporting them in a certain way. They are the unsurpassed field of the merit for the world. So if you want to give to an individual, if you want the highest kind of return in terms of karma, is given to someone who has this kind of insight, precisely because they have the ability to affect the world in a positive way. But again, remember the idea that giving is to be done. Where is the right place to give? Where you feel inspired is a different question from where there is most merit. And the reason again for that is because you want to learn how to give. And to learn to give, for this to become a force in the long run, you have to enjoy it. That's why it's important to give where you feel inspired, and not just to kind of be too obsessed about making merit, because you may actually destroy the inspiration that comes with that. So that is how you think about the Sangha. These are the people who have that access to that truth of the Buddha, the Dhamma, what it is all about, and for this reason they are special. And then you have the same kind of sequence that we have just seen arising as a consequence of that. And sometimes the way to kind of do this in practice, it can often be about recalling certain individuals who you feel are inspiring in this Buddhist teachings. And that can be individuals, they can be historical individuals, it can be individuals who are around in the present day, depending on where you find that inspiration. And there are some very beautiful examples in the suttas about monastics who are very inspiring. I was just discussing this with Venerable Akalaka just a minute ago, and I said, well, who do you find is your most inspiring kind of personality from the suttas? And he said, Venerable Sariputta. And I really agree with that, because that's exactly the person I also find often the most inspiring in the suttas, because he is the one with the greatest wisdom after the Buddha, and often he gives these beautiful teachings, and he talks about things in a way that often is, the Buddha doesn't even talk like that. He gives kind of alternative teachings to the way the Buddha teaches. And when the Buddha asks him, well, do you teach this out of faith in the Tathagata? He says, no, I do this because I know it myself. And it's kind of nice, isn't it? Kind of not too much respectful, but respectful in a wise way, in a kind of smart way. And that is really nice when you read that. But what is also nice about Venerable Sariputta is his whole character is very beautiful. The way he is portrayed in the suttas, he comes across as a very wholesome character, very humble. Here is the greatest arahant in the universe after the Buddha, and he's very humble. There is a famous story of Venerable Sariputta. He has his robe is kind of not put on properly. He's kind of falling off slightly or something. And then this novice, this cheeky little novice, comes up to him and says, your robe is not on correctly. And Venerable Sariputta looks, oh yeah, you're right. And then he fixes up his robe. And then he calls this novice his teacher afterwards. Thank you, teacher, for pointing out to me. It's very nice. It's so kind of humble. You know, you look at yourself, you see, have you got a fault? Well, if there's a fault, you accept that it's okay. Everybody makes mistakes, and it's impossible to be perfect in this world, even for arahants. That's all right. And then you accept that admonition, even if it comes from somebody so junior. And it's a beautiful example in the sutta. There is in the beginning of the Brahmajala Sutta, one of the most well-known suttas in the canon that is referenced elsewhere in the canon, the first sutta of the long discourses of the Buddha. It starts out with the Buddha wandering, and as he's wandering, I think it's towards Nalanda or something like that, there are these two Brahmins walking behind the Sangha. And these Brahmins are arguing with each other. One of them is saying, yeah, the Sangha, these scallywags, I have no kind of, these Buddhists, they don't know anything. And the other one, no, these Buddhists, they are wonderful, they are really nice. And then in the evening, when they arrive at the guest house where they're staying, the monks ask the Buddha, well, what are we supposed to make of this? These Brahmins arguing about whether the Sangha is good or bad. And then the Buddha says that, well, what you should do is you should ask yourself if it is true what they are saying. And if what they are saying is true, then you should just say, yes, it is true. Yeah, no problem. The Sangha is the Sangha good? Yeah, the Sangha is good. So, okay, no, that's fine. And if they are blaming you, and this is true, what they're saying in terms of, you know, of their blame, then you should ask yourself, well, if it is true, then we need to fix up what we are doing wrong and sort it out. This is all you should do. And if the blame is false, you can just shrug your shoulders and carry on because you know the blame is false. So either way, you don't take it too seriously, the blame or the praise. You just look at whether there is some truth to it. If there is no truth, you let it go. And if there is some truth, well, then you act accordingly. It's as simple as that. And it's a nice way of thinking about criticism. So when people are criticizing you, ask yourself whether there might be some truth to it. Don't reject it out of hand. It's so easy to reject it because we don't really like to be criticized. Sometimes you can reject it out of hand because sometimes it's obvious that the person is just coming from ill will and being stupid or whatever. You don't have to listen to that. But sometimes it is also obvious they might have a point. And then you listen. And if they have a point, they can. Sometimes people can uncover treasures for you. A treasure, something that you don't see for yourself, that may get you on the right track and help you to practice better. And this is, in a sense, what we're seeing here of Venerable Sariputta. Such a beautiful example from one of the great arahants. And there are a number of suttas like that where he kind of acts in a similar kind of fashion. And after a while, you really come to kind of appreciate this this person of Venerable Sariputta for his kind of great qualities. And there are a number of monks like that in the suttas who are very kind of inspiring in many ways. And so you can read that, you can recall some of these monastics, and you may feel inspired. It's not just monks, it's nuns as well. Unfortunately, there's much less of the nuns in the suttas. The vast majority is about monks, but occasionally there are little suttas about the nuns. And one of those suttas is the Chula Vedala Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 44, and this is the nun Kema, and she's speaking to a layman called Visakha. After she has finished, the Buddha praises her for being of great wisdom. And it's kind of one of these technical discourses, she obviously has a really good grasp of the technical details of the Dhamma. So wisdom is something that is really genderless. It doesn't matter what gender you are, it's kind of irrelevant. Wisdom is always available there. And I think it's very useful that we have both male and female kind of examples to follow after, because often we have, if you have some gender identity, and most people do, then it is nice to have someone you can relate to perhaps a little bit better. So it's good that we have both male and female role models in the suttas. It's interesting that the Buddha specifically says that. He says in one of the suttas in Anguttara Nikaya 2, I think it is, where he says that if you're going to take someone as an example, then he gives different examples for men and women. The women have other females as their example, whereas the men have other men as their example. And I think the purpose of that is precisely because sometimes we identify perhaps a little bit more easily with someone of our own gender than someone of an opposite gender. This is not absolute. We can be inspired by anyone, anywhere, really. It doesn't matter. But just as a kind of, as a little bit of a help to add to that inspiration that you may gain. So these are some of the stories of the ancient monastics, and of course there are many other stories as well, and some of them are more reliable than others, sometimes you don't know always what to believe, what not to believe, but I think some of these ancient ones are probably quite accurate. It's not just the ancients. Another ancient story which is quite remarkable, which I have been telling you a bit recently, is one found in the Mara Tajaniya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 50. And this is a story of this disciple of a previous Buddha, apparently. So I don't know how real it is and whether it's just a myth, a legend or whatever, but it says something about what happens when you meditate very profoundly. And this is a story of this monk who was a main disciple of one of the previous Buddhas, and he gets into this incredibly profound samadhi, the deepest samadhi you can possibly get into. And when you get into such a deep state of samadhi, there is no sign of life anymore. There's no breathing. Your metabolism has come to a stop. And for all practical purposes, it looks from the outside, looks like you're dead. There's no movement, nothing is going on, it looks like you're dead. So this monk, he was sitting in the forest, and he was sitting there, and these two men who were collecting firewood, they come by and they see this monk. And they say, oh, there's a dead monk over there, he's not moving. He must be dead. Okay, let's give him a good cremation. And because they're collecting firewood, very handy, right? So they just make this big funeral pyre, they take this monk, pick him up, and put him on top of the funeral pile there. And they light the funeral pile, and then they think, okay, we've done our job, and they walk off. And then the next morning, or a few days later, they are Buddhist, so they're giving alms in the morning in the village. So in the next morning, they're kind of giving alms to each bowl, and then they kind of look up, and then when they look up, they see this monk. But we cremated you a few days ago. What are you doing here? What happened? Of course, what happened is that he entered, according to the myth or the legend or whatever, if you go into a deep enough state of samadhi, you cannot be touched by these physical phenomena anymore. Nothing can happen. So you come out of your samadhi, you look down, there's a bit of ashes, you've kind of brushed the ashes off your robes, you get up and you walk off. This is kind of the story. Is it true? I don't know. It sounds a little bit, it's a bit hard to believe, but there is some truth to this. And the truth is that when your samadhi becomes incredibly powerful, it becomes virtually impossible to tell whether you are dead and alive. The only way you can tell is by touching the skin. Okay, you're still warm. Okay, so something funny going on. You've been sitting like that for hours. You're still warm. What is happening here? Well, that is the only way you can perhaps tell. But apart from that, there is no sign of life anymore. Because the calming down of the sankhara that happens through meditation practice, it goes so deep that your body stops. You don't breathe anymore, and the reason you don't breathe is because your metabolism goes to zero. When your metabolism goes to zero, you don't need oxygen anymore. So your oxygen in your in your blood, it stays the same. It doesn't decrease. You don't need to breathe. And everything just stops. Bang. That becomes why you become completely immobile. And this is not just in the suttas. I've been telling also recently the story, similar story from the when Ajahn Brahm was a young monk in Thailand, because in those days they would often sit meditation together with the lay people for long hours, sometimes during the whole night. And on one of these occasions, and they would sit on an asana, it's an asana, like a little bit elevated seat, and then all the lay people would come, and they would be there, listen to the Dhamma talk, and they would meditate together afterwards. And one of these nights, these Uposatha days, when everyone comes together, they would all meditate, and the hours would go by, and everyone would start leaving after a while, because, you know, you only can only meditate for so many hours. And eventually, there was only two people left in that hall. And one of them was Ajahn Brahm. Another one was this older Thai lady. This old Thai lady is really tough. Yeah, they have been sitting on the floor their whole lives. They can sit still for hours and hours and hours and without moving. And even if they have no meditation at all, still they can sit on that floor for hours and hours and hours. They're kind of super duper tough. So she was sitting there seeing who can sit the longest. Yeah, she or Ajahn Brahm, kind of competing. I don't think they were doing that, but this is kind of how it may have looked from outside in her. And then after a while, she kept observing Ajahn Brahm, and she looked at Ajahn Brahm, and there was no movement. Nothing was happening here. There was nothing going on. And one of the weird things that I have observed for myself when this happens is that when you get so still, the mosquitoes start to get confused. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but the mosquito goes around and around in circles around this person. They're not sure whether this is a person, is it a tree, is it a rock, what is it? They don't settle down anymore, go around and around and around. It's very interesting when the mosquitoes get confused like that. So after a while, this old lady, she's looking at Ajahn Brahm, and no movement of mind. So after a while, she gets up. She walks out. She finds some of the monks outside, and she says to the monks that, there's a dead monk sitting in the hall. This is what happens, yeah? And this is kind of some of those stories. And you realize, for that to be possible, for those of you who have been practicing meditation for a while and you know what meditation is like, you realize that someone who sits like that, they have a very profound state of samadhi. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able, if you can sit like that without any movement for hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, whatever, and there's no sign of life, and it looks like you're dead, you know the samadhi is extraordinarily profound. So this gives you a sense of, the noble ones, what it means to be a noble one in this world. It means that you have access to such things. It gives you a feeling that there is something in this world really incredibly valuable, very, very profound and very beautiful. And it gives you a sense that the Buddhist teaching is still alive, and it kind of draws you towards things. It gives sense to a sense of confidence and faith, because you see things that normally are impossible. People can't be like this. How can people possibly do this kind of things? It is almost supernormal in a more profound sense than the supernormal psychic powers we often talk about. It is supernormal in a very deep sense that people can access these kind of things. And it gives you that feeling that there are things in the world that are very profound and beautiful. And there are quite a lot of stories like this about, you know, monastics who have special kind of powers in this way, and special abilities, and who can do things that are kind of very unusual. Another very famous monk who lived in Sri Lanka, and he was a monk. He spent the first 10 years of his life just reading the suttas, internalizing all the suttas, memorizing the suttas in the old-fashioned way, because he had determined that after he knew the suttas, he would walk around Sri Lanka, never stopping in one place. And because he was going to walk around, he couldn't carry books with him. The only way to kind of have the suttas was to memorize them. So he spent 10 years just meditating and memorizing and understanding suttas. And then he went out of that monastery. This was the Island Hermitage, quite a well-known monastery, started by a German monk originally called Venerable Nyanatiloka. He was one of the early monks. He was more of a scholar monk. He wasn't so interesting as a meditator, but he started this hermitage. And lots of the most well-known Western monks who lived in Sri Lanka, some of the well-known Sinhala monks as well, they stayed on the island hermitage, and that's where they kind of gained their understanding of meditation practice. But then he left the island hermitage and he spent the next 40 years or so wandering around Sri Lanka, always wandering around, never stopping long at any place, staying at a nice place maybe for a few days just to meditate because it was good, and then as soon as people found out he was there, he would just move on again, never wanting to stay in one place. He might stop in a small village monastery for 3 months for the rains retreat, and then carry on wandering again. And he was famous for his meditation. He was famous for his ability to explain the suttas in very profound ways. And he was the one, Ajahn Brahm visited this monk when he was still alive. He died a few years ago now. And he met him in the famous monastery in Colombo called the Vajivarama Monastery here, one of the most famous monasteries there. Many of the greatest monks in Sri Lanka lived in this monastery here. And he also stayed there towards the end of his life because he couldn't move anymore. And Ajahn Brahm met this monk there. And the way he met him was, Ajahn Brahm didn't know about him at this time. This was back in the early 90s. And Ajahn Brahm had gone there to meet many of his other famous monks. Venerable Kaminda, for example, a famous Sinhala monk who wrote some books that Ajahn Brahm was very impressed by, and many of these other monks. Bhikkhu Bodhi was staying there. And he asked Bhikkhu Bodhi, well, you know, I met all these famous monks, is there anyone else I should see? And Bhikkhu Bodhi said, I have a special jewel that you want to see here. I'll bring you in. And he took him to see this monk called Venerable Jnanavimala was the name of this monk. So he took him in to visit this monk. And then Bhikkhu Bodhi said, yeah, okay, you know, you just have a chat with him, I'll go and do something else. Well, that was a big mistake. Yeah, and so what happens, because Venerable Jnanavimala was not famous for giving Dhamma talks, but when he got inspired, he would give a Dhamma talk. So Ajahn Brahm sat down after paying his respects and all of that, and then he gave him a Dhamma talk going on for an hour and a half or something like that, a long Dhamma talk. And this was without any, this was kind of just off the top of his head, yeah. And Ajahn Brahm said this was the best Dhamma talk he'd ever heard in his life. And part of that Dhamma talk, and maybe I can say one of the highlights of that Dhamma talk as Ajahn Brahm tells it now, and for those of you who haven't heard this before, some of you will have heard this before, but it's a really kind of nice story, the story about how it happened that this monk went forth. And he was German originally, and he grew up in Germany in the interwar period between the First World War and the Second World War. And at this time, this was a time when kind of people were, you know, like always when there's peace, people are enjoying themselves. And one day he was out in the city at night. And when he was out in the city at night, he walked past all these places where people were enjoying themselves, like the Bierstube. It's like a place where you drink beer in Germany. Stube is like a room, yeah, or a beer room or something like that. And it's like a pub, basically, a German version of a pub. And they were all kind of hanging out, all these young people, yeah, enjoying themselves in this Bierstube, and he saw this. And then as they were enjoying themselves, there was a fire started on two or three stories higher up in the same building. And these young people, they kind of saw the fire, said, yeah, whatever, yeah, fires take a long time to burn, the buildings, no problem. And after a while, the bartenders left, so people thought, yeah, free beer, yeah, now we stay even longer because of the free beer. And that is where the danger comes, because desire overtakes your common sense. And so he watched this happening, and the flame spreading out in this building, becoming worse and worse, until eventually what happens, more and more people left, there's a few people left, when the whole building collapsed on top of these people. And what was so powerful about this, for this monk, was that he realized that this is a metaphor for life. This is a simile for what life is like. Life is like that. You are full of craving, and because you are full of craving, you are heedless to what is going on. You are blind to the danger that is there, because craving is driving you on just to enjoy yourself. And as life, as death is approaching so fast, everything is about to crash in your head, yeah, still you are heedless. And then, as a consequence of that, you end up with death, or death-like suffering as a consequence. Everything comes crashing down. This is what life is like. You run around being heedless, enjoying the pleasures of the world, and then one day suddenly everything comes crashing down in the middle of your silly heedlessness, not really knowing what you're doing here. And at that point, when he understood the power of that simile, he decided to become a monk. And so he left for Sri Lanka, and he did become one of those really great monks. He became very famous in Sri Lanka, and he became very famous for his incredibly ascetic lifestyle and for his power of meditation and all of that. So that is how what he was like. It's a simple story. There's nothing really kind of, when you look at that story, there's nothing really super normal about it or anything like that. And you probably had to meet him to feel some of the power of the mind behind it. Is precisely often those simple teachings, those kind of simple little insights that they have, that actually is often the most impressive with some of these monks. So these are some of those stories. There are many, many more of these stories, and you find these stories from people of all nationalities and background, both male and female. Some of the famous female teachers, for example, we have right here in Perth, we have Ayavayama, who started the monastery, the Dhammasara monastery, staying in a caravan by herself for a couple of years in the beginning. That's pretty impressive to be able to do that. Other kind of famous nuns is Ayakema, who started one of the hermitages in Sri Lanka for nuns, and she was one of the very first bhikkhunis in the Theravada tradition in the world. She ordained back in 1988, a long time ago, and she was well known for having good meditation. And she actually came to Bodhidharma Monastery, that was back in 1992 or something, and she gave a talk on meditation to the monks. One of the very early experiences of a nun, a bhikkhuni, giving a talk to the male sangha at Bodhidharma Monastery here. And she was one of the people who inspired Ajahn Brahm to start teaching about the jhanas. Because prior to that, Ajahn Brahm had never really taught the jhanas. Not sure why, but it wasn't a done thing perhaps, so he didn't do it. But then he saw this nun doing it, and he thought, okay, if she can do it, surely I can do it as well. So she inspired him to do that. That's quite nice, isn't it? And you can see how very often if we had left out the nun sangha, you wouldn't have had that possibility of learning from this what this nun was saying. So again, we don't need this hierarchy. Sometimes by tearing down the hierarchies a little bit, you gain access to teachings that you otherwise might not have had. So this is one of the reasons why Ajahn Brahm then started teaching us about samadhi so much, because of that experience with Ayakema. So there are some great nuns around, there are some great monks around, there's lots of people out there to be inspired by because of these sort of things. One of my favorite stories of psychic powers, have you heard the story of psychic powers? This is a really powerful story. This is kind of, whoa, this is kind of, it blows your mind when you hear this story. And this was a story of the famous monk Ajahn Gamha, Thai monk. Also a disciple of Ajahn Shah, and he stayed here in Perth on a few occasions. He stayed for 1 year, and he came back and stayed for a few months later on. And he's very famous for his metta, and famous for all of his kindness and all of these kind of things. You can go to Thailand and meet him. He's still alive in the present day. And he came to Perth, and he stayed here for a year in the very early days, when Ajahn Brahm and everyone was building this monastery over here. One day Ajahn Gamha was there, and one day the local mayor, in the middle of the building work, and they were really reliant on the shire to get the permissions. They were very important to have good relationship with the local shire, especially the mayor. The mayor was like a strong personality. He was like the leader of the local community. He wasn't very democratic perhaps, because he was a man you needed to kind of be on good terms with. So one day this mayor, he happens to walk into the monastery here. And the first person to see this mayor is Ajahn Gamha. And this mayor, he was kind of a big Australian fellow with enormous tummy, a really, really big tummy, kind of hanging out over his pants, his trousers. And then Ajahn Gamha gets to see this Australian man, and he's really fascinated by this enormous tummy. Never seen anything quite like it before. I think in Thailand in those days the tummies were still smaller. I think now they are expanding in Thailand as well, but at that time still quite more slim. This was back in the mid-80s. So he goes up to this mayor, and he looks at him, he takes out his hand, and he starts patting him on his tummy. And Ajahn Brahm, just at that moment, Ajahn Brahm comes out and he sees what is going on. And he says, oh no! This is the end, yeah? We might as well sell the property and might as well move back to Thailand, because there's no way we're going to get any more building approvals after this. This is just not done. You don't go around patting strangers on the tummy in Australia. You can't do that. Probably can't even do it in Thailand, but certainly not in Australia. It is not kind of culturally accepted thing to do. Imagine if you go around in Perth and start patting random people on the tummy. They will probably say some really nasty things to you if that happened. But what happened? And this is kind of the kind of the supernormal power in these kind of situations. What happened? Because you come from a place of such that is so different from ordinary people. You come from a place that is very natural, very gentle, there's nothing to be frightened about with people like that. You feel so relaxed in the presence because you feel like there's nothing there that there's kind of complete acceptance in a sense. So instead of getting upset, this mayor started to just giggle, yeah, and kind of, he was just so happy here. And he kind of, what happened, instead of being upset, after that, all the kind of building license, whatever they did, they went through like that. No problem at all anymore. Ajahn Gana had worked his magic on this mayor. Isn't that kind of amazing? It's amazing, and what is so amazing about it is that if you have a certain character, if you have a certain kind of kindness about you, a certain kind of softness, then you can do things that nobody else in this world can get away with. That actually is a kind of supernormal power. This is the sort of things that many of the great monks in history have done, and they have got away with precisely because of that. And you can use that sometimes to your advantage, as in this kind of situation right here. That is one of those examples of these things happening. And another very, actually I think I told this story already, I'm not going to talk about that, but another similar example is the one where Ajahn Brahm went to visit Ajahn Tate in his famous monastery in the northeast of Thailand. And Ajahn Tate, he couldn't even see him. He was kind of disappeared. And his mind went completely blank when he visited him, because he was sitting there in the corner and he felt this complete acceptance. When someone is so highly attained, they never judge you. They never look at you in a bad way, but they accept you for who you are. That is so rare in this world. People always judge each other. But in the presence of people like that, never judge. Because they know who you are. They know about people. They know that we all are worthy of compassion, because we're all trapped in samsaric existence without really knowing what we're doing. So compassion is what comes from wisdom. And you see that in some of these people. So these people exist everywhere around the world. You find them in all Buddhist cultures. So it is very nice to be able to meet some of these people, because it gives you a sense that Buddhism is alive. It is still working. The path is not died out. Sometimes you hear people are being cynical. They say, yeah, there's no arahants anymore in the world, so we have to live for the next Buddha instead. So we're going to go and we're going to become disciples of Maitreya Buddha instead. It is not a good idea. It's a very bad idea. Maitreya Buddha is a pie in the sky. Don't know anything about him, when he will be around, whether there is such a Buddha. It's just too absolutely uncertain. Buddhist teaching is still alive today. Now is the time to do the practice. If you don't do it now, you probably will never do it. Even when Maitreya Buddha comes down, you will just dismiss him. Whatever. I'll wait for the next one. And then you carry on like that, and you never really go anywhere. So this is some ideas about how to reflect on the Sangha. And sometimes some of these monastics, they live far away in the jungle, and despite the fact that they live far away in the jungle on very simple ways, still they are often very happy and very solid people despite that. And these are the things that are very inspiring, because you realize there's something more in this world. You realize that there is an inner thing, an inner happiness, an inner contentment that can be attained, that has got nothing to do with the world. In fact, it tends to arise precisely when you give up the world. That is when that inner happiness, the inner glow, the inner insight and samadhi actually start to arise. And it's very wonderful to know that, because it gives life another dimension. You start to understand about real spirituality deep inside of the mind of anyone. And you know, because other people can do it, you know it is there for you as well if you practice in the right way. Anyway, then we have the same sequence happening as we saw before. When the noble disciple recollects the Sangha in the right way, what happens? Well, because you see the spiritual qualities, the mind is no longer obsessed by desire, ill will, or confusion. Because you are seeing where real happiness is, you abandon that. And your mind is straight based on the Sangha. The noble disciple whose mind is strained gains inspiration in the meaning. Yeah, the meaning of that, those special qualities. You understand what it is all about, where it is heading. You are inspired by the Dhamma because the teaching is a teaching that is there, available to you, heading in the same direction. And you gain joy connected with the Dhamma. And then as you meditate with that basis, based on these things, from joy comes the rapture, from the rapture comes the tranquility, from the tranquility comes the deep pleasure, the sukha, and from the sukha comes the stillness of the mind, the samadhi. And this is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops the recollection of the Sangha. So there you are. This is again a way of developing that confidence that we're talking about. We're still talking about the five spiritual faculties. And this is how that confidence starts to arise as the first factor of these first of these five spiritual faculties. There is another way of doing this, and this is what this next sutta is about. It is to broaden out that perspective a little bit. Sometimes it can be difficult to gain that joy, especially in regard to the Buddha. It may be a little bit easier with the Sangha, because sometimes you can meet some of these Sangha members, but you can actually broaden it out even further. And this is what this last one is about. And in this case, the teaching is not directed specifically to noble disciples. In this case, it is broader. It is really for everyone. And there's a slightly different approach. And this is to Nandiya. Nandiya was another of the Sakyans. So he was also part of the family, the broader family of the Buddha. And this is what the Buddha says to him. Again, Nandiya, you should recollect good friends. Thus, good friends are the Kalyana Mittas. It is truly my good fortune and gain that I have good friends who take compassion on me, who desire my good, who exhort and instruct me. Thus you should establish mindfulness internally based on good friends. Nandiya, a noble disciple who possesses these 11 qualities, this is only one of the 11, abandons the bad, unwholesome qualities and does not take them up. So the bad qualities are abandoned. Just as a pot turned upside down does not receive back the water that has been poured out, and just as a fire that has gone out of control advances, burning up a dry woodland and does not return to what it has burnt, so too a noble disciple who possesses these 11 qualities abandons the bad unwholesome qualities and does not take them up. So here you broaden out the idea to talk about Kalyana Mitta in general. That's a much broader group of people. And it makes it easier to kind of have, to kind of appreciate this larger, broader group of people. Of course, the number one Kalyana Mitta is the Buddha himself, so it includes also the recollection of the Buddha in this. But it is not just the Buddha, it is also the other Kalyana Mittas, like the Sangha. We've just been looking at the Sangha, that's also Kalyana Mittas, especially when the Sangha is practicing well, well practiced as we have seen here. These are also Kalyana Mittas, but also anyone in your life that is supportive of you, that is leading you in the right direction, any kind of, all the people who are here on this retreat, they are your Kalyana Mittas, at least for now. And anyone who supports you in your life as a Buddhist, who makes you lean in the right direction, head in the right direction, is the Kalyana Mitta. Anyone, as it says here very beautifully, who desire my good, who have compassion, who exhort and instruct you because they want to support support you. These are the people who are your real Kalyanamitas. And so this is what we should do in life. If you want to be a Kalyanamitta to someone else, you should do it out of compassion. Not to control, not because you want the other person to kind of see what you have seen, because it makes you feel more secure in your own religion if other people also take it up. Very often we are driven by these kind of defilements. Yeah? If we can get someone else to see what I'm seeing, it's almost like you feel more sure about your own teaching as a consequence. So try to persuade others, and if they don't get it, you feel a bit frustrated, but surely it's obvious, and you try a bit harder, and really what you want is you want your own doubt to kind of subside a little bit. But it shouldn't be like that. We should teach others purely for their own good. And if they don't want to listen, it's okay. They don't have to listen. We just do our best, and then very often it will have good consequences. Sometimes it doesn't. We make the Dhamma available in the world, but we don't become obsessed by converting others to these teachings. And that is the right way. So feel blessed sometimes. Feel so fortunate that you have so many Kalyanamitas. The Buddha Society of Western Australia is a very strong Buddha society, especially in the Western world. It's very difficult to find Buddha societies like this. And what a wonderful thing it is to be part of this. Yeah, you have this great opportunity to be part of this wonderful Buddha society where over 1,000 people keep the 5 precepts on a regular basis. Actually, it's even more. I have no idea how many. There's a lot of people who keep the 5 precepts on a regular basis. Just to remind you how amazing that is, I always like to tell the story of from Thailand, where Ajahn Chah, on one of the big days, maybe it was Vaisak or something like that, and there was lots of people in the monastery, hundreds and hundreds. Yeah, all the local villagers who come to the monastery were there, and they were sitting around, and Ajahn Chah looked out at this ocean of people everywhere looking out. And then he asked them, how many of you keep the 5 precepts? Yeah, I think he was about to give the 5 precepts or something. And then if you don't want to keep them, you kind of cross your fingers. Yeah, if you don't want to keep it, hold it behind you. Okay, not keeping that one. So maybe you keep 2 or 3 or whatever. How many of you keep the 5 precepts? And then of all these hundreds of villagers, all of them being Buddhist, there was 2 people who raised their hands. Yeah, and then Ajahn Chah told them, you are all... famous thing, you are all dog excrement. Yeah, I don't think he used a more coarse word than that, but you know the feeling. Yeah? And of course, dogs, they are the lowest of the low in Thailand. Yeah? So very bad. And so it shows you that just because someone comes from a traditional Buddhist country doesn't necessarily mean that you're practicing very hard. Some people are, some don't, just like everywhere else. But the Buddhist Society in Western Australia, because many people come to Buddhism because they want to practice here, people are often very serious about what they're doing. And what a wonderful thing it is to be part of a community like that. Rejoice in that. It is rare in the world to find this. You're very fortunate to have this support. And when you think about it can quite easily give rise to a bit of joy and happiness that you're part of such a wonderful community with all the people coming together, monastics, lay people, men and women, all supporting each other. So that is the last of those little reflections that I want to talk about. It has just turned 9 o'clock, so it's perfect timing as well. So please see if you can put these things a little bit into practice, because this is so important to have some support to give rise to joy in life. It is not always easy to give rise to that joy, so you need a little bit of support to do that, and this is how the Buddha recommends that we should do it. That is all for now. We'll see you back again at 3 p.m. this afternoon.